Welcome back to season 6 of the Reconnected podcast. Today we're going to be discussing the topic of coaching in sports. And who better to bring onto our podcast to talk about coaching than Dr. John McCarthy, aka Coach Mac, who is a beloved clinical associate professor of applied human development in the graduate program at Boston University's Wheelock College of Education and Human Development, where he is in charge of the sports coaching specialization and also teaches and supervises the sports psychology students. I'm so grateful to have known Coach Mac since starting my graduate studies and training at BU many years ago, and currently have the honor and privilege to call him a colleague as I now teach and supervise the counseling graduate students in the same program. To those of you who are listening who already know Coach Mac, he does not need an introduction. You know him from his passion for improving the conditions and experiences of sports and coaching. You know him by his compassionate heart in pioneering and leading the Get Ready program for Boston inner city kids. And you know him for his positive and thoughtful approach as a professor, as a colleague, and as a friend. For those of you who do not know Coach Mac, here's a brief bio. Dr. John McCarthy received his undergraduate degree from Williams College, an incredible liberal arts college here in Massachusetts. He went on to receive his master's and doctorate degree in developmental studies with a specialization in sports psychology at Boston University's School of Education. Currently at BU, he oversees the coaching specialization in physical education, health, and coaching graduate program. He is also the director of the Institute for Athletic Coach Education, which offers training and education for coaches in the community, particularly those who are involved in youth sport. Dr. McCarthy has extensive practical experience gained from 15 years as a coach at the college and high school level. He has also been highly active in the field of coach education. He has been the regional coordinator for the NFL's coaching academic program and sits on several advisory boards for organizations that are aimed at developing youth through sport, including G. Rowe Boston and the Starfish Foundation. And we are just so, so happy to be sitting down here in the studio with Coach Mac. This is just such a pleasure for Alexis and I.
Thanks, Jerry. That was a lot to take in, but appreciate that wonderful introduction.
Awesome. Well, you know, Alexis and I, we always say that this podcast is a way to give back. We want people to learn about topics maybe they're not completely familiar with, or even if they are, to learn from someone who's been immersed in these topics for their professional life. I think you're just such a wonderful example of really wanting your career path and everywhere you put your energy to make things better, you know, and particularly with those involved in sport. You know, we've been saying on the podcast that, you know, when you watch sports, you can to celebrate the successes, the championships, people celebrate who's scoring the most points. You know, you get the highlight reels, but there's so much that goes on behind the scenes, you know, and the students that we teach and, you know, just practical experience with the athletes and the coaches and the people we work with, you realize that there's a lot that goes on behind the scenes that doesn't get discussed in society as a whole. But it's very, very important because people spend so much time in sports. It's not like they just jump into sports, they jump out. People spend, you know, their whole youth, right? Or their whole, you know, many, many years of their life involved in sport. And some even go on to coach as well. So just so happy to hear, to have you here to share and shed a light on this topic of, you know, the inner workings of the psychology of coaching and the psychology of sports.
I would say too that for our listeners that I feel like everybody at some point in their life becomes a coach, whether it's like our inner coach where we're coaching ourselves through tough and tricky situations, or you're a parent or a caregiver or just a friend. Sometimes we have to coach each other to get through different moments in life. So if you're not like an athletic coach or a sporty person, there's still going to be a wealth of information that I think will be shared and shed some more light on through this conversation. So we're really glad you're here.
Oh, it's great. I always think of like, if someone says, do you want feedback? And you're like, not really. But then if you say, can I give you some coaching? Then people often respond better to that.
That's a really great reframe. I like that. Yeah.
I love that. So Coach Mac, tell us a little bit about how you got into this area of, you know, really wanting to support coaches and kind of how they go about the philosophy and the process of being a coach, which is more intricate than people may realize.
Well, it's a good, it's probably a multi-headed question, but I think growing up, I played sport and I enjoyed playing lots of different sports growing up. And I was fortunate to have the opportunity to do that and do that through high school and even college. And then I think after that, I was probably still tied to that identity of, you know, being an athlete or identifying with that kind of the camaraderie of sport. And, you know, I bounced around for a while trying to play beyond college. But at one point, I was fortunate to actually know Bill Parcells. And I had volunteered coaching high school football kind of in between trying out for teams and doing stuff. And I coached at a high school in New Jersey, Manasquan High School. And I worked for this really legendary high school coach. And he was really good at the techniques and tactics of sport. He could have coached at any level. And he had a lot of really interesting ways of coaching. And I remember the first time I ever coached and I thought I knew a lot of stuff. And in the middle of practice, I was coaching the receivers and I was talking to them about how to do something. And all of a sudden I hear he had this real high-pitched voice and he said, "Hey, McCarthy, sentences, not paragraphs." And I was like, "Oh, okay."
You know, sentences, like not paragraphs.
That's like, so good.
Stop talking and get them doing some stuff. And so like, I had these early experiences where I was realizing I didn't know as much as I thought, even having played for quite a bit and experienced a lot as a player at a fairly high level, I actually didn't know that much about. And I was also really stunned by he could stand behind the offense and look at all 22 players, both the offense and the defense, and he would point to like, "You're out of position. You went backside. You should go front side." You know, it was like,
wow.
And I remember saying like, how the hell does he see that? Right. Mm. So he was a master coach. He was somebody who had studied it, lived it, and thought about coaching all the time. But, you know, I was like volunteering. It wasn't like a sustainable lifestyle. And then I had the good fortune, as I mentioned, to meet Bill Parcells, or Bill Parcells happened to have gone to the same high school I went to. And so Parcells was this, you know, legendary Hall of Fame coach. And he said, "When are you going to get a real job?" And, you know, he had this really kind of rough way of saying, he's like, "I got a guy who's looking for somebody." And so I ended up starting coaching, college coaching at the United States Merchant Marine Academy in Kings Point, Long Island. And that was a really like, an interesting step, because now I started to meet all these guys who it was their career to be coaches. And I was still kind of one foot in, one foot out, like thinking, I'm not sure this is for me. But that job, I worked there. Then I worked the next year at Wagner College as an assistant coach. And then one of the guys I had worked with at the Merchant Marine Academy came up here to Boston University, and they had a position open. And so I was sort of doing that, you know, climbing the ladder, like I think people would think. Mm. And it's a very, you know, coaching in that time particularly was you weren't getting paid much at all. And you really had to have a passion for it. Yeah, sure, the guys at the highest level were paid decently or handsomely, but at that time, you know, I remember coming up here to Boston, you know, I lived in my friend's basement of his basement apartment. And, you know, we were just working 70 hours a week and coaching. And it was a part of that that I really loved, you know, the camaraderie, the feeling of putting together a plan and trying to get the team to come together and execute it. But I started to realize it was a lot more than I, like you say, behind the scenes than people think. Mm. You know, I always laugh when people would say, "Well, the season's over. What do you, you know, do you just have off the rest of the year?" And it's like, no, it's like we're watching film and then we have spring practice and we're doing recruiting. And it's like, it's all not, there's not a lot of downtime, right? And so, but somewhere along that journey, because I was working at Boston University, I was able to take classes. Well, there wasn't much time to do it, but I took like one sports psychology class and I was like, wow, I really like this. And it took, I would have to fit it in during the summer. But every time I went to a class, I was like, this stuff, how the hell do I not know about growth and development? Mm. Or how do I not know about teaching and learning? Or how do I not know about motivation? Or how do I not know about the psychology of, you know, and it was kind of, I felt like so both energized and also kind of like scratching my head, like, how does anybody coach without this knowledge? Like, I was a history major in college, so I didn't know a lot of this stuff. I didn't have a physical education teaching or learning background. And so, and then I looked at my colleagues and I said, well, that's true of a lot of these guys. They don't, one guy was a fireman, one guy was, they didn't have the training. And it became more and more obvious to me that there was a huge need. I would almost go back to like the coaching office and I'd be like, what about this? Or why are we doing it this way? You know? And they would look at me kind of sideways and, And I remember this one guy, I think it's kind of funny now, Wally Dombowski, he used to call me the professor. And it was like, it was
foreshadowing.
The foreshadowing. I didn't know he was on it, but it was like, because I was always kind of wondering, like, there's got to be a better way. Like, this doesn't seem like the optimal way to be approaching these guys. Mm. And not that I had any answers, but because coaching is super hard. It's like at any level, coaching is challenging. I've coached my kids in youth basketball. I've coached, college age, Division I scholarship players. And it's like anywhere in between there, my experience has been, it's just a different challenge. It doesn't matter where you're coaching. It could be coaching Little League baseball or youth soccer. And each context has its own challenges. So that's the initially how I got really, was my first kind of like, awakenings to like what coaches might need. And then I would say, but kind of fortunately for me, it was a sad event at the time, but Boston University in 1997 dropped their football program. Mm-hmm. And it was a real crossroads moment for me because I met my partner at the time and they were in the program and, now am I going to go just find another job wherever it is? And I remember like feeling like, am I letting go of something here? Because in coaching, especially college coaching, the worst thing you can be is out of a job. Mm-hmm. So that's why these guys will take a job anywhere all over. They'll pack up their family and leave because they know if they're out of a job too long, they might not get another job.
I think it looks bad on the surface.
Yeah. So it's some people say it's at that level, it's a good job, but a crappy profession, because it's super stressful. If you got to pick up your family and move, it's kind of like a military family. It has to like, okay, you're moving, shipping out of here, right now. And so that was part of my calculus to say like, I don't know. But I was getting more and more interested in like just all the stuff that I was, became interested in during my master's. I was able to finish my master's right when they dropped the program, fortunately. And then pursue the doctoral program like you did at BU. But during that time, I was, one of my jobs, a part-time job I had was working with a program called Play It Smart, where they did academic mentoring with urban and rural football teams. So it was funded by the National Football Foundation and partially funded by the NFL Players Association. So it was this really cool program because it was developed by Al Pettipaw out at Springfield College and some Dan Gould and some other people that were in the sports psych field that were really trying to do that academic counseling for this, urban football team, right? So it was kind of an interesting role. It was kind of a step back for me, back to that high school age group. Mm. And what I really liked about it was like counseling training oriented. So we were there to try to provide academic resources, structure, support for kids to take the SATs and ACTs and, you know, develop their, you know, pathway to college or to, a higher level of education or training. And so what was really cool about that was like, I was getting an introduction of how to work with this unique population. It was at the Madison Park Tech Votech School. So these are kids who, you know, not the highest performing academic kids, but kids who are following trades or following other kind of pathways that wasn't the high academic achieving schools that we think of, but they were kids that just really looking for to improve their life. And I really enjoyed working with them. But in the time I was there, I probably learned a lot about what I didn't know about culture, about inequity, societal inequities, how unfair the landscape is in terms of, you know, sport participation and resources and access and affordability and transportation, all these things that I just sort of, you know, when you're coaching scholarship football, you're like, you just tell the guys to show up and they're there. But now at Madison Park, these kids are like, coach, I got to babysit or leave practice in the middle, or I got to leave, go get, you know, medicine for my grandmother. Or now you're like, oh my, like this is a different, this is a different endeavor.
And sports is so expensive now for kids.
And that these kids did not have those resources. And most of their parents or guardians were working one or two or three jobs. And, you know, if I had a parent meeting, the parents couldn't come. They just didn't have the space to do it. And at the same time, I started coaching their JV football team. So for 5 years, I coached like 55 kids by myself.
Wow.
And it was like actually an unbelievably demanding job because, you know, I wanted to do it because I felt like I could, like I knew a lot about football at that point, so I could teach them football. But man, in that 5 years, I had to keep relearning, like, how do I teach these kids? Some of these kids had learning disabilities. Some kids had language disability, you know, language differences. They had, you know, they didn't speak English, some of them. You know, some kids are just immigrant kids that, you know, from Nigeria or like culturally, all this stuff was happening at once. And I think that provided me like a rich tapestry to kind of look at to say, oh, man, I don't really understand a lot here. And so I was getting my doctorate, but I really say I got my doctorate at Madison Park.
Wow.
And, right. And so I think that was a really important step in my kind of journey of understanding people who come from different backgrounds than I came from. You know, I'm white, middle class, blue collar kind of. My dad was an FBI agent, so I had a certain kind of military. My dad was in the Marine Corps. My brother was in the Marine Corps. It was like a certain kind of experience, but, you know, that was not my lived experience, you know, being in these kind of neighborhoods where kids had to deal with violence, kids had to deal with poverty, kids had to deal with, you know, lots of things that I didn't have to deal with. So that was an important step for me. And that's, I know I'm kind of long-winded here, you know, how did I get to where I wanted to work with coaches? I felt like that, those experiences really informed that pathway of like my own discovery of like what I don't know, really helped shape, you know, towards the end of my doctoral program, I want to work with coaches. And some people are like, is that a job? You know, it's like, I don't know if it's really a job, but it's like, it definitely is needed.
Yeah, there's so much there. Oh my God. And I just want to give a shout out to my sister because she has a similar experience of wanting to help kids with executive function and that job didn't really exist. And she's like, well, similar to you, like I just want to make it work. And she just started and did it. And it's really been helpful for people. But John, there's so much there that you shared. I just want to give a larger theme of your story, which is that you developed your philosophy about coaching and about working with people through all of your experiences. And it just shows what kind of a lifelong learner you are to go through experiences at every level. Like you said, like coaching is hard at every level because it's unique. There's contextual challenges. And it's always hard because you're trying to help someone. It's like even just trying to help your friend is hard, right? Let alone a group of 20, 50 people, right? It's helping someone is a hard endeavor. Right? We know that even as therapists. So
I was just going to say too that I don't know if you know this, John, but our taglines for the podcast are actually like life is hard and also be open, be curious, be well. And I feel like your whole story you just shared was all about being open, being curious, and cultivating wellness among the group of athletes or even other coaches. I'm sure we'll hear more about that, how you get the coaches to be on board with your philosophy of doing things too, which it's, I don't know, in my opinion at least, and I think Jerry might share these values too, I think that's what life is about, right? Because when we are open and curious, we don't make assumptions about what might be needed, even though we have all this research and knowledge and wisdom from all the studies we've taken on for ourselves. Like as much as we know, we don't know. And I just appreciate that so much that you shared that.
Yeah. Thank you. You know, what made me think of immediately was like, I also, part of my decision to not continue on at the, you know, climbing the ladder in college football was increasingly there was a feeling of I'm not well. Mm. To pursue this the way it's being pursued feels like it's not going to get better. Mm. You know, the amount of time we spent like just watching film per day and the kind of every weekend, you know, recruiting or, you know, like there was just an imbalance that sport has become, football was sort of like the leader in sport becoming hyper professionalized and organized and
like obsessive almost.
Yeah.
Well, the excessive preparation is part of the ethos at the higher levels, absolutely, where you can never prepare enough and there's always more to do. And there was a feeling of being a bit trapped in that. Mm. And I remember talking to my dad, and my dad was an FBI agent. The guy worked hard and he knew how to work. But like, I remember having a conversation with him and he's like, what are you doing? And I'm like, I'm in the office, Dad. And he'd be like, you can't work that long. You know, like you're not going to be useful after a certain point. Mm. And it really stuck with me. It was like, he was right. It was like, it doesn't matter what you're doing. If you're grinding yourself to dust, you're not that sharp. You're not really that, you're not going to make good decisions. You're not going to feel good. Mm. And there's a cause to that. So I like that tagline because it's it's adding, you know, be curious, but, you know, more that wellness is sort of like a life balance issue, I think, in coaching in particular.
We just interviewed the author of a great book, How to Be Enough, right? And Dr. Ellen Hendrickson, who's actually from BU too at the Card Center. And we had this conversation about there's a fine line between perfectionism and taking care of yourself, right? And you need to figure out how to straddle that line because to be whatever qualifies as the best or successful in whatever chosen path you have. It does require some self-discipline and sometimes going a little bit above and beyond, but to pay attention to that wellness piece. I mean, I constantly am straddling that line, and I admit it on the podcast frequently that, you know, this is part of my own challenge, because I think like you, and I know like Jerry too, I just love my job, that sometimes it blurs the lines between like professional path and personal path, because it's just such a passion of for me that it doesn't feel like I'm doing work.
And coaches definitely feel that.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say.
With their identity and everything,
Yeah, there's this, I think for athleticism, and I hope we could talk about this more too, like once you enter the world of sports, whether you're a player or a coach, there's such a strong identity that connects to that, that I think makes navigating different phases of life kind of challenging. And I hear that in your story too.
Yeah, something that I, you know, currently that I talk to a lot of the students at BU about is the very thing that has gotten them to be successful. It's like that discipline and that hard work and that, you know, that kind of mindset where they just keep going and push themselves through. That very same quality at some points becomes a liability.
And I love that.
I feel that's especially true with coaches. I can remember there was a guy that worked with us at BU, a guy named Jason Swepson, and played at BC. He became later was a coach at Elon, and I coached at North Carolina State. And he was working with us then. And I remember it was like Thursday, and our tradition was sort of like, we would just grind it out. And then at some point on Thursday, he put his feet up on the desk and he would start reading the paper. And I start to get annoyed, you know, I'm like, and he'd be like, because I was the offensive coordinator, he was a receivers coach, and he'd be like, hey, Mac, you got anything else for me? And I'm like, no. But then he said, okay, well, I'm out. And I was like, I was damn annoyed with him. And I was like, you know, we got a game coming up. You know, like, this is important. But it's like, I didn't have anything for him to do. There was nothing else for him to really do on a Thursday night. You know, we're going to have our last walkthrough on Friday and then play the game Saturday morning. It's like, what happened? I got enculturated in my early years. It's like, there's always more to do. There's always more to do. And like, the further I get away from that, I see how obsessive and perfectionistic it is. And that tendency is rewarded.
Yes.
Because you are prepared and you are, you've seen every scenario. And then if you're trying to prepare other people, you feel like, well, there's never enough. But I think that never enough kind of feeling.
It's probably on a lot of t-shirts, actually.
Yeah.
Never enough.
Never enough. Yeah, that's true.
It is quite detrimental to the coach. And I would even say it's an ethos that is spilling out on the athletes in a way that they feel they've always got to be doing more, and they got to be more focused and work harder. And it's quite oppressive. It's not very liberatory in its orientation. So I know success requires you to do that. But I think, how do we find that balance? I think that's an important, we're here for you to support you too.
to go to the
Cape and
that's
relax.
Right. That's right. There are very many moments of that. My dog keeps me balanced. Yeah.
I love what you're saying though, that it does spill over into the athletes. And like, you know, we've talked about my practice and other people that, you know, who work in the sports psychology world, is that they end up talking about this like grinded out mentality to just work harder and harder and harder. And in our perfectionist episode, I point out like that's driven by fear. It's not driven by intention. And there's athletes I've worked with who are just, they don't really even know what makes a good practice. They're just, I don't know, spending 8 hours practicing in a day, and they don't even know what makes it good or bad. So they try to almost like have a perfect ending to the practice to make them feel like they're a good athlete. And if that doesn't happen, they're just not a good athlete on that day. And it's like such a roller coaster. Like, you know, Ken Rivers' book, Heads Up Baseball, talks about the roller coaster of confidence. And this type of mentality is a very all or nothing mentality that, you know, when I try to work with these athletes is make what you're doing more intentional. Because if you're just driven by fear, it's just going to be this up and down roller coaster. And it's not sustainable, like you're saying, right? It's actually detrimental to feeling confident and feeling loose and feeling ready in that type of way, because it's not just...
And finding the flow of the moment instead of just grinding through it.
Yeah, like forcing it, yeah.
Yeah, it makes me think that a lot of, you know, I teach the undergrad sports psych class in the springtime at BU, and I've totally kind of changed the way I teach it than I used to teach it. Was used to teach concepts and, you know, goal setting and visualization, and we still do all that, but it wasn't until I started to shift the focus to how do you perform better. And pick something that you're working on. It could be, 1 year I had a guy who was a pop-up chef, whatever that is. And then I had another young woman who was an EMT. She was a brand new EMT, and she was struggling with, she would sit in the front row because she was struggling with, like, she would get on a call, and if she didn't react soon enough, people would like push her out of the way and just, you know, start the code or do whatever they were, you know, the IV. And she was like, she really had a reason to get better at her performance. And then, of course, there's a lot of athletes in the class and other people who are musicians who are just trying to do better in school. But we really try to, like, break it down. Like, performance is performance. Like, it could be a test. It could be the violin. It could be playing lacrosse game on Saturday afternoon. And when I started to orient the class around goal setting and performance, like, process goals, like, you know, how do you want it to be? How do you want it to feel? And this is a very foreign thing to them, because they do have this, I call it the Kobe Bryant grind set. You know, it's like, I'm gonna shoot 500 shots before everyone else has come to the gym. And, you know, then you see it's tagged on Instagram, and then it's like held up as the answer to greatness. And it's like, maybe, but, you know, we kind of forget that Kobe's dad was a professional coach. He had these unusual qualities physically and all these other things that made him super special. And then maybe sometimes he wasn't even that nice a person, you know, someone might say. But I think for them to discover how do they want it to be is, to me, that's an individual journey. And it's a very important part of that intrinsic motivation to do something. Because I think because sport environments now are so, they are driven so early for this excellence and early specialization and a lot of investment, and it's very elitist in the way it's set up. And these young kids give up a lot of their lives to go to get a scholarship or to play at a higher level. And it doesn't necessarily give them room to discover why they're doing it for themselves. And I think that, to me, that's the important work, both for, like, how do we coach coaches to create an environment where the kid can be themselves and contribute, obviously, reach their potential. But there's a lot of competing narratives about, like, how coaches should coach. And I think, to me, that's interesting. You know, it depends on who the kids are and what their goals are. But even within that, I feel like coaches feel kind of obsessed and are sometimes driven to take that out on their players in a way that's counterproductive.
Wow.
I was just going to say, when I was in my first year of undergrad, I actually took a sports psych class. I was drawn to it. I actually almost went into sports broadcasting as my career path. And then for various
and
reasons,
here you are,
I shifted.
You're doing it.
And here I am. I mean, a lot of the skills I learned through that path and that part of my path actually have helped me a lot of ways as a public speaker, as a teacher, as podcast co-host, all the things. But it's very interesting when you think about the people who show up who want to learn about sports psychology and you want to learn about performance. And I was very fortunate in my graduate studies to have like multiple paths of what I learned. I crammed in as much as I could and got as much as I could out of it, where one of my three primary paths was positive youth development, right? And when we think about coaching especially, that's such a big part of the puzzle. So you mentioned the developmental side of things. And I think from a coaching perspective, it's so important to hold on to the fact that there are so many individuals who are not necessarily on this like linear trajectory to start at point A and end up at point B. There are going to be so many twists and turns and nutrients from a developmental perspective, positive nutrients that we need to be able to invest in their journeys.
I think it's not a one size fits all.
It's not at all, right? Jerry always brings up, I love it, the universal design for learning aspect of things. You know, nothing really is one size fits all. Like some things, even in, you know, I always say even in our evidence-based world, as much research as we have, even in scientific research, it doesn't work for everybody all the time either.
Yeah.
So as a coach and thinking about how do we nurture these gifts and challenges that you see before you, I think it does require this, as you're describing, kind of taking a step back and looking at what people's goals are, because the primary goal might be, how do I perform better? But as you mentioned, their secondary or tertiary goals might be like, how do I show up for work? How do I show up in a relationship? How do I show up in these different contexts? So as a coach, I don't see you as just like coaching the sport athletic side of things. I also see it as you're developing individuals and humans. And depending on what level you're coaching at, you might have a different experience or different needs right before you.
Yeah, for sure. When you talk about positive youth development, I think one of the things that I try, I have a methods of coaching class I teach in the fall, and I really try to get the students who are going to be coaches to consider, like, because we have this very elitist approach that, you know, we're setting our kid up to be the, you know, get the scholarship to go to Stanford or something. It's like, actually, so few people actually get to that level that we've designed a system that serves almost nobody.
Yeah,
perfectly.
So glad you said that.
Wow.
And so, yeah, it's great for maybe those, you know, few that actually go to a scholarship level or a professional level. But it's so infinitesimal, the number of people that get that opportunity. There's only 300 to 400 players in the world that play in the NBA.
Yeah.
The world.
Yeah.
Think of it. So it's like, that's insane that a parent is thinking my kid is going to play in the NBA.
Yeah.
Of course it could happen, but the problem with it is it's inverted. It's on its head. It's like we think, okay, we're going to set up our AAU systems and everything to get to that level. And in the meantime, we're basically telling a lot of kids, you're not good enough, and you shouldn't get the benefits of that playing sport. Like in Norway, Norway's kids play into their late teens. And Norway, for the size of the country, does way better in like the Olympics than not just the Winter Olympics, like than a much, like, we have a massive population, you know, compared to Norway. And we, you know, you're like, how is it possible that Norway, or how are we worse at soccer than Iceland?
Yeah.
You know, because our system is so set up to like just grind it out and really not in have the kids enjoy it.
Yeah.
There was one of my former students who played here at soccer at BU. And he said, I don't understand the U.S. He's like, all my teammates are like so sad the season's over. And it's like, in Iceland, we just keep playing.
Yeah.
You know, he's like, Yeah, my friend who was, you know, he didn't get good till he was 29. Huh. And he's the guy guarding Messi in the World Cup. And it's like, what a different way of thinking about it. They play because it's a part of their community value. They play into their adulthood. And it's not about, you know, grinding out these young kids and then, you know, the few that emerge from it. And so I think for me, it's a lot of thinking about how can the kids, when we're talking about positive development, first enjoy their experience, want to play longer, mm-hmm. Get the benefits of friendships and skill development and that sense of competence that they and discipline that they learn in a team setting. Mm-hmm. And, mm-hmm. you know, the dropout numbers are bad. Like for girls, it's around 11, sometimes 10 and a half, feeling that I'm no longer perfect or something's changed.
Big time, yeah.
And because of that, I'm not good anymore or I don't look the part anymore or something. And, you know, we lose those kids at early ages to, you know, sometimes a lifetime of not enjoying physical activity.
Yeah.
And so from positive youth development standpoint, that's why, you know, we've run our program at Boston English High School for the last 18 years because I started out working with teams over there, but I realized like even that was elitist to say, oh, we only work with the sports teams. Mm-hmm. So now we work with we work with the school to send us kids who want to move. And some of them are athletes and we can help them, develop, teach them how to weightlift or box or develop skills. But it doesn't have to be.
Yeah.
But we want to teach them the joy of working together, the social and emotional skills that you can learn from working in a group. And we have certain frameworks for working with that.
Self-reflection.
But, yeah. It's like, it's not just about who's the fastest, biggest, strongest. Yeah. It's about, you know, how much do you care about your teammate and or your classmate? And that work is, to me, every kid could benefit in that physical activity setting from those skills that you and dispositions that you develop through that activity.
I love it when I work with families who say, my kid is a little averse to sports, but I want them to get the benefit of moving their bodies, working together with others, learning through failures and challenges to be a part of a team. And I think like that is the beauty, especially if I'm kind of talking more about youth sports here. But also, you know, I see the other side too, where these kids are in so many clinics or involved in multiple teams at the same time. And it's not to say it's good or bad. I just think to your point, it's important to say, what is the intent and the goal of doing this? Mm-hmm. Because if it is to find joy and build skills and interact with each other, like that's a beautiful thing. In fact, in my Universal Design for Learning work, my friends and colleagues I cast just redesigned their guidelines to help teachers to understand how to make learning environments more flexible and accessible. And a key point, one of my favorite parts of these new guidelines is they talk about promoting joy in learning, because I think we've like sucked so much out of that, thinking about just the end goal, which as you mentioned is like such a small percentage of people will get to the level that I think a lot of families and youth athletes and especially collegiate athletes are trying to achieve, which is, it just blows my mind sometimes. But I think this idea of joy is the most important thing. And thinking about coaches, and parents and teachers and any adult in the life of a younger person, like that's kind of our responsibility is to share joy, not just to say like, go do something joyful, but to be joyful with.
Create the context for it to happen, which takes a lot of intentionality.
Create the culture, create the opportunities to have some fun.
That's where that's where the coaches come in, because the system that the sports system that exists has become very much professionalized. Mm. And it's also designed for people to profit off of. Mm-hmm. Like when I was a kid and even in high school, nobody made any money off of us.
Yeah.
You know, like the coaches did it. They were the dads in the community that wanted to help out. And my high school coaches were all physical education teachers or history teachers, those kind of people that were like lifelong educators.
Mm.
And the environment has shifted, you know, well, these AAU clubs and different soccer clubs and all the hockey clubs, they're big money.
Mm-hmm.
And there's somebody's making money off of it.
Mm-hmm.
The tournaments and the showcases and all this stuff is like,
they the highlight are, reels for yeah, the kids that are made all in this, sixth grade.
All this stuff is an industry.
Mm-hmm.
And unfortunately, none of those, I wouldn't say none of them, there are some well-meaning people, but the way the system is set up, it's recruiting people into the environment that are trying to profit off of it, trying to use those kids to get to the next level or to, and I think the educator, coach as educator model is, you know, not in the U.S. ethos for sure. So I think reclaiming some of the purpose, the joyfulness comes from a coach who's, and there are so many great coaches that are doing this, but it's, one of my mentors was a guy named Mike Luke, who was a coach educator, and he called it random acts of coaching.
I love that.
So if you're fortunate enough, you just randomly get this coach who gets it, who makes it a joyful experience, who's helping you develop your skills, helping you learn about teammate, you know, being a good teammate. And, but that's just random right now. And we could do better than that. You know, we could do better than that.
And it doesn't have to be like a either or. I think in a society, everything feels like an either or, where it's like, if you're joyful, you're not really getting better.
Mm.
And I remember one of the textbooks that we have as part of the curriculum for your sports psych program was the Gene Williams book.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember reading this quote. It stuck with me for like so many years. It was like, was Bobby Knight a great coach because of his antics or because he was just a good basketball coach despite his antics?
Mm. Well, yeah. I mean, with those, Bobby Knight was a tactical genius.
Mm-hmm.
Like he understood.
For the audience who might not know Bob Knight.
I actually brought this up to a high school student. He's like, who's Bobby Knight?
Yeah, and yeah,
I'm like,
yeah.
Wow. Okay.
I know. Could we operationalize who he is as a coach?
He was a famous, I think he had the all-time number of collegiate wins
in
Indiana and then at Texas Tech in. But he also was known for having like an unbelievable temper, you know, would throw flower pots at his secretaries. He would choke his players. He would throw chairs on the floor when they didn't get. And so because he had so much success, he's, you know, still lauded as, you know, one of the greatest coaches ever. But then it depends on what your measurement is. If it's just wins, yeah, he's fantastic. But for the young guy, he choked and, you know, or players that suffered with his displeasure, you know, then not so sure it would be the same experience. And
and this wasn't like a football coach where you're supposed to like channel that aggression into a hit. This is a basketball coach who you're supposed to be finessing the game on the court where aggression might actually mess with your performance. That's just my opinion.
There's also some selective bias in a coach like that, right? Like he's going to select players that are going to be willing to tolerate that, which makes it look like it's okay.
Yeah, I mean, I think this, unfortunately, I like how you framed it as like there's a either or, you know, you have to be this way or that way. And I don't, you know, in the coaching classes that I teach is like more being more nuanced about it is it depends. It depends on the context. We know that at professional sport, the coaches and high level college sport, it's a demanding job. And the demand is for them to win.
Yeah.
You know, I also thinking about my job pathway back in the day, I remember when the Nebraska football coach at the time, back then, was a guy named Frank Solich. And he had followed up a legendary coach, and his team went 10-2 and he got fired.
Wow.
And you're like, that's because the expectations at Nebraska are really, really high at, during that time. And so you have to have some empathy for these coaches that really are hard driving, or that can be seen as controlling and or aggressive in their tactics.
It's out of fear. Yeah.
I think it's not that I endorse it, but I have empathy for how hard their environment is and what the expectations are on them, and just how cruel the higher level is. It's for every coach who gets that head coaching job, there's, you know, several assistant coaches that might get fired the next year, have to move their family and find a new job, maybe never find a job that's paying you as much as you were being paid. Right. So it's like the environment is challenging. But back to Bobby Knight, it's like you could be really good at the techniques and tactics of sport and be very successful.
Mm-hmm.
But this is also what got me into, like, you know, why during my doctoral studies, I was really interested in, you know, how coaches develop successful teams. Because there, you know, that if we could bottle that, folks, you know, but there's no one like easy formula, right? And so for my dissertation, I interviewed 20 of the most successful college and professional football coaches at the time. And it was really interesting to me to see a wide array of styles of coaching. And to me, that's really hopeful because, you know, some were organizational geniuses, some were more teaching and motivational. You know, they're setting up a motivational climate where people really thrive. Some had more kind of humanistic vibe to it. And so it was good to see throughout that. You know, I interviewed guys like Bill Parcells, who's kind of an old school, you know, Theory X, you know, they're lazy, I got to make them work harder kind of coach, to a guy named Frosty Westering, who coached at Pacific Lutheran, who was, you know, he was an educational psych guy, he had his doctorate in educational psychology, but he had come out of the Marine Corps. Wow, he just understood intrinsic motivation and wanting people to play because they wanted to play. So kind of the whole range of these coaches were super successful, but it was encouraging to me to say, wait, there's not one answer to this riddle, you know?
Mm-hmm. I was just going to say too, thinking about one of your original comments you made about looking at this team of urban football players that you worked with and saying to yourself, oh, they might actually need a different approach than I am thinking I need to go into this with. And I'm thinking about especially collegiate athletes or professional teams where kids are coming from so many diverse backgrounds with different value systems, with different experiences.
Different ways of learning.
Different ways of learning, different traumas that they might bring with them into their playing and into their lives and into this new context. And, you know, I see this all the time through, you know, clients Jerry and I share or stories that we share about, you know, when you come into college, when you live somewhere else, you're coming into a new community, coming into a new space, a new place where, one, you might not be familiar, you're meeting all different kinds of people, might not be the best fit. You might not even know what the best fit is for you.
Mm-hmm.
And then if you're an athlete, you're asked to perform at the highest level because they brought you onto this team or you've earned your spot on the team. And that requires like so much. And then you have a coach most of the time who's like, I know what I do to do this well, and I'm just going to do it. And you all have to adapt to that. And you're saying, you know, maybe there's a different place in between to think about or some other aspects of psychology or education and coaching that maybe we can pull into this I think, incredible field, because I think sports are so valuable, whether you're a spectator or you're an athlete or a family member that's cheering somebody on. I think there's so many really unique qualities that go into just sports, which not everybody always gets a chance to see.
Yeah.
Oh, absolutely. Makes me think of, like, I teach a class that I developed called the Psychology of Coaching Teams. And a lot of that is really just what you're saying, is that how does the group leader, who's the coach, develop a group that believes they can have success? And because when they're coming from a new place, they're adjusting to a lot. What's their history? Do they have a history of trauma? Do they have a history of, you know, some difficulty that they're bringing with them? And I always think the team is this wonderful place where we can, you know, Jerry would know about the Erwin Yalom's work in group psychotherapy, where it's like, it's not a therapy group, a team. Mm. It's not. But
I don't know if it really can be, because then it changes the context.
Yeah, a therapy group for people who are suffering and life isn't going so well, right, usually. Yeah. But, and that's why they're there. Mm. But a team actually has a goal, and their goal is to be successful. And it's a really positive frame to do that work of, like, for us to be more successful, all of us have to change and grow and develop and align our purposes. And there's some beautiful possibility there for people learning those skills, those interpersonal skills, and kind of developing some altruism towards the other people in their group. And all those things that in a good therapy group are, in my view, present in a good team, you know, those therapeutic factors. And it's really the coach is just orchestrator of creating that environment where you can be your best self and you can be your best self and I can bring my best self, and we put that all together. And that's such an exciting thing behold when it really comes together. It's
incredible.
Extraordinary, right?
Yeah.
And
that's why they say it feels like a family.
Yeah. And it's hard work. And there's lots of up and down, and there's sometimes two steps forward and then three steps back. And it's like, you know, but when it happens, it's a beautiful thing to behold. You know, even if our group at Boston English High School, we have kids come in, and when they work together and they share and they shout each other out and they learn stuff, and it's like, man, you're like, that is just awesome, right?
Yeah.
And we can do it if we facilitate that environment. And to me, that's, I guess, what I've learned later is, like, there's no one right way to do it, but there's definitely approaches to, like, how we can do it a different way.
Mm.
You know, like, one of the things I learned earlier, there was a guy who actually wrote his dissertation at BU, a guy named Bennett Lombardo, who wrote the book Humanistic Coaching.
Mm.
And he observed, like, I don't know, it was like 700 hours of coaching, and he was just shocked at how, like, the coaches didn't ask any questions.
Mm.
No legitimate questions. Like, they would say, well, are you crazy? Are you kidding me? Well, that's really not a question. he would say that.
But you hear it on a lot of teams, right?
Yeah, listen on the sidelines.
Yeah.
It's like,
yeah.
What are you doing? You know, like, those are not really questions. Mm-hmm. It's like
shaming, actually.
Yeah, it's mostly.
Yeah, great point.
You know, putting the kids down, or, you know, those kind of rhetorical questions are threatening. And I think one of the things I learned is, like, really just asking kids, what do you need? What are you trying to do today?
Mm. Why did you do that?
Yeah.
Like, so I can understand why that happened.
Yeah. Mm. Even why is a little bit challenging sometimes.
Mm. Right, right.
Say, help me understand.
Yes.
Or is there, what other ways are the way to get the ball down the court? You know, like, there's lots of ways that we can approach kids so that they learn in this not top-down way.
Yeah.
And from running the program over at English High, I realized, and having worked at Madison Park, I realized that top-down way, you can get people to comply.
Yes.
Yeah.
And especially the sport of football, it's like, it's always get on the line and get set and do this and take your first step to the right. And it's like, mm-hmm. we are good at getting people to do that, but are we good at getting them to understand why they're doing it?
Yeah.
And there was this funny moment. I was coaching at Madison Park, the JV football team, and I was in the huddle with them, and I called a play. It was a sweep right play. And I looked at every single kid. And I said, you got it. You got it. Got it. And they all said, yes, coach. Yes, coach. And I was like, all right. And then we go out and run and play, and all 11 kids do the wrong thing. And I was like, holy cow. What? Well, then I started to go through it. Oh, Juan, you weren't here yesterday because you had to leave early. And then, oh, you weren't here. You were sick. And I was realizing all these, and I started to have to learn how to teach better.
Yeah.
So I'd say, you know, after that, I would say, okay, let's go up on the line, point to which direction the play is.
Oh, that's smart.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Then take your first step in the direction we're going to, and then
broke it down.
You know, it was like, I had to like slow it down and learn how to teach better. It was not their fault. It was my fault. And I think when kids are not having success, we often blame the athlete. We pull them out of the game and say, what are you doing? You can't miss that ball or whatever. And you hear this over and over and over, or you're not mentally tough, or you're not, these just constant blaming of the kid instead of the coach. You know, my biggest thing is like, if the kid is not having success, that's likely our fault.
Didn't you say there in your dissertation there's a great coach who actually, that was like his philosophy of like, if they're not doing well, it's because I didn't set them up for success in some way. And to your point, I just want to get this in here real quick, is that you're really talking about trust and vulnerability to really ask a question to someone and them being honest, like, oh, I'm sorry. Like, I literally was distracted about the homework I had because I have a paper that's late. That's why I didn't do it. Like, to be honest and to be vulnerable with someone requires so much trust in that relationship. And I love what you're saying about just creating the culture where that is expected. That's okay. That, well, I'm going to hear you out and we're going to just understand each other better. And it's just more effective anyway.
I'm going to piggyback on that because it's funny that you went there, because that's like so valuable to the work you do. And then I'm immediately thinking about, okay, that trust actually relates to how our executive functions actually come online. Because if we're stressed and we don't trust that I'm going to learn something here versus being shamed by the situation that didn't go the way I wanted it to, it's going to shut down your ability to learn, adapt, make changes.
Yeah, people panic.
From an executive function perspective, those frontal lobes, especially for younger athletes or younger people, aren't fully developed yet. And we do see that a lot of athletes oftentimes, you know, might have ADHD or attentional difficulties, or their executive function systems aren't working as well. So the way you like broke it down and pulled it back and was like, okay, let me build trust in you. Let me show you a different way. The fact that you did that in that situation, I'm breaking this down for the audience. The fact that you made that connection to say something was missing here. Let's actually break this down and made it a learning opportunity. That just taught them a million lessons just in those few moments, right? It taught them that they could learn something differently, that they can actually slow themselves down to think about what it takes to get to where they're headed.
And more clearly.
Right? That not, okay, I didn't get it, but wait a minute. Other people might not have gotten it also. Like, maybe my question is valuable because it's not just about me. It's about everybody, making sure we're on the same page to work together. And that coach saw that and wants to break it down and support us.
And that player's going to want to like work harder for you because of that, right? They're going to be like, oh, that's my coach has my back. I'm going to want to like even work harder. And that guy you interviewed for a dissertation, wasn't he the most winningest D2 coach?
No, John Gagliardi, who actually the Division III championship trophy is named after him. He's the winningest coach of all time.
Wow.
Amazing.
In 64 years.
Wow.
Think about that. 64. He was, he had three.
What sport?
Football.
Okay.
He had three losing seasons.
Wow.
Which is so far, you know, the three standard deviations from the norm, right? And he said this exact thing, which was, if a guy, he said, well, at first he said, do you like to get yelled at? And I said, no. Mm-hmm. And he said, well, I don't like it either. I don't want the president of the university coming down here, raising holy hell with me. So, you know, I would never yell at my players, and because I wouldn't want to be yelled at. So if they can't do something, it's because I didn't teach them how to do it. Mm. And so if I put them out there, that's my fault. Mm. And he said, if I have to put them out there because there's nobody else who can do it, that's also my fault. And it was so liberating to me. It was when I was one of those like smack your head, forehead kind of moments where like, oh my gosh, he's putting the entire onus of the player's performance on himself.
Yeah.
And his ability to teach them and prepare them and get them ready to have success. You know, he's not putting an immature person out there, probably going to struggle. Yeah. He's saying, when you're ready, and I understand that you understand, you're going to have success. And that confidence, yeah. But also from a learning, you know, your expertise, Alexis, is that, you know, learning and executive functioning. I think, you know, because Jerry and I share this kind of sports psyche background, where it's mm-hmm. motivation and visualization and goal setting and, you know, breathing and all this stuff. Yeah, that's important for sure.
Yeah. But, and that helps me in my work too,
yeah,
by the way.
Yeah. And it's part of the deal of performing well.
Yeah.
But I actually think a lot of the stuff that I'm interested in working with coaches actually has much more to do with teaching and learning yes. stuff, because that's the stuff I didn't have. And, you know, that basic, you know, back to Madison Park when 11 guys do the wrong thing, mm-hmm. it wasn't their fault. It's like, I didn't check for their understanding before they went out and ran the play. Mm-hmm. And I should have had better ways of as I was had to learn to say, wait a minute. I didn't teach it clearly enough. Mm-hmm. Or,
they weren't ready for it. Yeah.
And now if I put the onus on me, then I spend more time on that.
So sometimes, especially with athletics, depending on the context of where the athletes are coming from too, as they join a team, they might have learned skills differently, right? And then they join a new team and mm-hmm. the coach has this expectation of, you know these skills because you're on this team, but their interpretation of what they're being asked for or techniques might be different. Yeah. So what you guys are saying too is like, we need to get a better understanding of how skills are being developed from a learning perspective, and then also consider the performance side. So I don't think those two are separate, because in any kind of change in life, any kind of learning or wanting to improve oneself, like all of that is a part of that process. So I just want to point out too that you're making a really great point to the coaches out there who are listening. And I want to validate both the coaches and the teachers, because sometimes we know all the right things, but we don't have enough time to give it to like actually learning well. Sometimes it's like, oh, I got to get this down and we need to move on to the next play.
So true.
Or I need to get this lesson down. And, you know, if there's half the class that's failing, that's kind of on them to step up and have the responsibility to do what they need to. Mm-hmm. But I love how you're emphasizing the point of like, if something's not going as planned, we need to take a step back and look at ourselves as coaches, as educators, as adults in the lives of younger people or other people that we're working with, to see what tweaks and shifts and changes might be necessary.
Yeah, it was the last year I was coaching here at BU. There was what I considered a master coach, this guy Dan D'Orazio. Mm. Rest his soul, a fantastic teacher. And I remember he was a very, very intense guy. And he would be standing on the side when we were running plays. He coached the offensive line, I had a script of plays that we were going to run in practice. And then we ran a play and it really didn't go well. And I said, I'll go next play. So that means, you know, we have to get ready, defense ready to run the cards. And, but I see Dan on the side and he kind of tilts his head. And then I pause for a second. I go over to him and I say, what's up, coach? And he's like, John, we can't run that play. We can't run any play. Mm. And I still get chills thinking about like, he was like, don't just run plays to run plays. Mm. It's like, do them, figure that one out. And we'll, if we figure that one out, we'll probably figure the next one out. We might have to spend a little more time on it. And where's the gap in the understanding? And why didn't we throw it to the right guy? And all that stuff is like, we get our plan as a coach and we just want to follow it and run through it and feel good and pat ourselves on the back. We got through 60 plays today. And it's like, but did they really learn? Mm. You know, did they know, did they understand the nuance of it? That was a good lesson for me.
Yeah, that's great. It's like you're saying, it comes down to intention and priorities. You know, what are you prioritizing with the time that you have with the athletes? And how is it being utilized? It's just such a fantastic philosophy of how to go about being a coach. It's really thinking of yourself as, how are you facilitating that time? Coach Mac, there is kind of, I do want to just get your take on this because it's a pretty significant aspect of athletics. It's things that I have seen sometimes working with athletes, and then you hear stories through people, you know, in the sports world that sometimes, like, there could be bad things that actually do happen within the sports world. And sometimes it's intentional, sometimes it's not, you know, just there's different reasons for it. And, you know, we try not to stigmatize people, anyone involved in things that happen, but we do want to try to understand it. And so can you speak a little bit to, you know, kind of sometimes when like things kind of go bad and wrong, and it's not just because someone lost or maybe, you know, like feels bad because they lost a match, but something, you know, more deeper than that, when it's like, oh, that person really kind of was in pain because of what was going on in their sports team, not just because they lost or something like that.
Yeah. Unfortunately, there are a very, very high number of incidents in youth sport, college sport, high school sport, where there's a lot of work being done by Gretchen Kerr at University of Toronto that would characterize a lot of the abuse and as what she calls relational maltreatment.
Mm.
And when we, unfortunately, because there's an incentive structure around sport to succeed, sometimes the methods and approaches that coaches are using are really sometimes misguided.
Mm-hmm.
and harmful.
Mm-hmm.
And we, sadly, a lot of the abuse will be tolerated, like we were talking about with Bobby Knight.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
It's like, if most people choke their players, they would be fired immediately.
Mm. Yeah.
But he wasn't fired immediately because he was so successful.
Mm-hmm.
These scandals, it's like this stuff is pretty prevalent.
And kids getting overworked and getting injured or hurt because of the inappropriate ways of training.
Yeah. So there's these levels of abuse.
Manipulation. You know?
And I think we need better athletic leadership.
Mm.
Because, like in college sport, for example, athletic directors used to be former coaches.
Mm.
Because they understood the coaching domain, they understood the difficulty, they understand how hard it is for coaches to recruit and to spend the time away from their families and to. But I think increasingly, especially during the NIL, you know, name, image, and likeness era, where money and boosters and mm-hmm. all this stuff is really big time,
mm-hmm.
that I feel like there's going, you know, we're in a new period where if you're making money at something and it's big time, you know, reward there, then the possibility for abuse is much larger.
Mm.
And so that's what I'm getting to this, like, athletic directors used to be these coach type people. Now a lot of them are fundraisers and facilities people and, you know, booster, you know, guys
business
who
minded.
Can smooth the money out of people. And I feel like that's a red flag, because at the athlete coach level, there's going to be a lot of incentive to just win, no matter what happens. And sometimes coaches have immature notions about how to get people to do things.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it sets the stage for a lot of this relationship abuse. If you don't line up with my expectations for you, I'm going to punish you. I'm going to
shame you,
rank you lower. I'm going to, you know, do things that could be quite inappropriate. And I think a lot of times colleges will fire a coach and they will just let him go. And they'll say, oh, well, you know, thanks for coaching with it, you know. And I think for that psychological and physical safety is we need athletic leadership that can help promote the same way coaches can create facilitate an environment for the players.
Mm-hmm.
I think the athletic directors, we need these human-centered type athletic directors, or at least assistant athletic directors that are trying to set up an athletic department or a team department or a high school athletic department that has shared values and has shared approaches and has some supervision.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like if the coach wins, does that mean that whatever they do is okay?
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's usually what they say.
There's so many things going through my mind right now. I'm thinking about, you know, this idea of supervision and if you're winning, doesn't matter. And I'm also thinking about, you know, the people that are in these positions of power of some sort, athletic, you know, directors or even just coaches, right? Like it trickles down to how people see sport. And I'm thinking back, and I have to give props to this student I work with who's now a ninth grader. Last year, he was an eighth grade umpire. And it was the greatest story because it really rocked him. He was umping this game for, I think it was second graders, right? You know, youth baseball. And the coaches were yelling at each other and cursing. And he had to step in as an eighth grader and say, this is inappropriate. You know, this is not the way we're supposed to show up to be a part of youth sports. And he did such a brilliant job moderating these two grown adults, parents of kids who were on the teams who were cursing at each other. I don't remember the exact context, but, you know, when we see these like people who get away with bad behaviors because they're winning or because of whatever the case, they're making money for the team, you know, that trickles down to how coaches think at all levels, it's okay to behave. And I think this is a bigger, grander societal conversation probably too. Yeah. But I think in the context of what you're sharing, I think it's so important first to step up and one, say, this is not just about money, even though sports is one of the highest profit earning industries. I think that probably is. I don't know the specifics, but I'm sure it is. But also thinking about, you know, how we conduct ourselves is actually dictating what comes next for the athletes, the players, their families, their lives, right? And this is what I love about positive youth development too, is that this is not just about getting through school or athletics. This is about being able to grow in a healthy way. And ultimately, you know, there's different ways of interpreting positive development. But, you know, the Lerner camp, Richard Lerner and Jackie Lerner, who I was privileged to work with Jackie at BC, you know, they think about the last C of the six C's of positive development as contribution, as giving back. And I think sports has such a huge responsibility in remembering that piece of it.
And it has that potential.
I hope. I mean, maybe this is my naivety, like in thinking about it, but
it's happening out there, both the good and the bad.
Yeah.
It's these arguments and these disagreements are happening all over the place, but also there are these beautiful things happening in the sport context. And so it's how do we create the environment where it's more likely to happen?
Yeah.
Yeah. I love all three of us kind of like the energy we have here is so beautiful and amazing because we come from the same place of like wanting to understand, wanting to help. At the fundamental level, there's more people listening to this who can kind of get involved in any type of aspect, right? The eighth grade kid
was being the, stepping between the adults, right?
The parents and the league actually nominated and gave him an award for the way he carried himself and how he set the tone for what youth sports should be, which I am so proud of.
And he wasn't doing it like for attention or anything. No. It was like an organic, genuine thing coming from the kid's heart. And like all this little stuff gets, you know, like you can make a difference in such a small way.
Yeah.
Even if it's not like for attention, you're not going to like go on SportsCenter for it, right? There's so many ways to contribute, as you're saying. I love what you said, Lex, contribute.
Not just random acts of kindness or coaching, but intentional acts of kindness and coaching. Can we shift to that?
Yeah. Right? Well, so I think, you know, getting to your point, Jerry, and really echoing what Alexis is saying is that even with the positive youth development programs, a lot of them say all this, you know, this is what we do here. And I say for a couple of years, we got grants to study some local youth development programs here in Boston. And then we got another grant to study Little League Baseball in Alston Brighton, Hyde Park, and Mission Hill communities.
Oh, wow. I didn't know about this.
And so we went around and we observed the coaching of all these different organizations. I went to a lot of Little League games. We went to softball games, you know, T-ball and the next level up. And it was fascinating because we started to ask people who were running these organizations and saying, I remember this one meeting we had in Hyde Park. You know, it was in like a Knights of Columbus. And the guys are like drinking beer but they're listening. And we're like, at the end of a year of T-ball, what should a kid know and be able to do?
Wow, such a great question.
And for a while, they were like, it was as if we asked them, you know, how do you split the atom? You know, like they were like, what do you mean? And I was like, well, that's my fault. It's like, what does every kid got to be able to do so that the coaches of the next year in Hyde Park, it's called Pony League. When they play Pony League, then every coach would know every kid got exposed to it. And so then one guy raises his hand and he says, like, a good batting stance. And I'm like, yes, that's a great one because it's a foundational skill. Everyone's got to learn how to do it. They can have their own individual style in it, but you got to have a solid batting stance. Mm-hmm. And another guy goes, well, you know, kind of funny because they've seen this before, to run around the bases in the right direction. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, yeah, that's actually a thing, right? Like, they don't understand. Every year you see a kid run to third base. So it's like, that's something we can teach the kids.
Yeah.
Not that they're all going to be the next, you know, Cal Ripken or something. That they know some basic skills. But then it was really cool because after the session was over, a guy came over to me and he says, I didn't say anything, but I'm an electrician. And what I want my kid to learn is how to be a good teammate.
Mm.
And I said, that's an outcome that we can't teach everything, but we could definitely be intentional about saying, this league's about teamwork.
Yeah.
And so we talk about it, we enforce it and model it, we show it, and we show how to do it.
Yeah.
And yeah, sometimes you have to say, that's not what we do around here.
Right, of course. You know? Boundaries are normal, yeah.
Yeah, like at our program 2 days ago, Thursday, one of our eighth grade boys was at the end, was shouting out one of our BU grad students that worked with him. He said, I want to thank Ari for helping me with the bench press today. We're like, yeah, that's great.
Ari.
But then he said, yeah, but he's weak.
Huh.
And I said, hey, did you just put him down too? And he's like, no, I didn't mean that. You know, and it was like, because we got to show him he did great work, right? He was working out, he was learning, he's shouting out somebody for that help. But then he's been taught elsewhere, if I put him down, that's cool, you know?
Yes.
Or if I'm going to feel better if I do that. But then in that moment, we just sort of like said, that's great. And then that part's not so great.
Yeah.
And like everybody needs that help, especially an eighth grader, you know, because they're trying to figure out how to be.
Yeah.
And so I think that's what we can do is show folks like, how do we want it to be?
Yeah.
And what's our intentional way of doing that? Mm-hmm. And then when everybody in the environment knows that.
Yes.
And that becomes a shared language, a shared parlance, a shared way of being.
Mm-hmm.
Then people will hold each other accountable.
Yes.
Yeah.
You know, my friend Lou Bergholz said, you know you have a culture when the kids defend it.
Yeah.
Oh, that's beautiful. Yeah, yeah.
So it's like if you were putting someone down, Alexis would go to, hey, Jerry, we don't do that here.
Yes.
Right?
Jerry, I would never put anybody down, like quite literally.
Yeah. So I think that intentionality is like what we could infuse in our coaching a little better, and really think about what we value and we want. What do we want? Like, I love this exercise of like, if I ask the students, it's like, if your kids were talking about you as a coach, what would they say?
Mm-hmm.
Or what do you want them to say?
Yeah.
Because then that brings that to the next level of like, oh, I gotta walk this talk and I gotta talk this talk and I gotta show them over and over that this is the important stuff here.
Mm-hmm.
And it's ongoing. It's every day.
Yeah, it's not just words.
No, that to me, that's the one thing I've learned running programming. It's like we start over every day.
Mm.
Now you build some trust with a kid, like you're saying, trust is important. But then you get a new kid, or it's a new group, and then you have to start over, and you have to have clear what you are trying to establish. And once that, you know, once you've had some run with those kids, after a while, they know how it's supposed to be.
Yeah.
And then they bring their own unique flair to it. And that's the fun part.
What you're saying applies to every level, right? It's not just youth sports. It's not just, you know, in the classroom. It's any type of group that you're leading or involved in, for sure.
Or family. You know, family, I was thinking too about my work, that a lot of people come to me and say, just give me the answers, give me a protocol, give me a thing to do. And I'm like, it's not that simple. It's about intentionality and integration of a lot of these things that we've been talking about here.
Yeah.
And it goes back to what you were saying before. We can drop feedback on people as they're learning, or we can invest in their learning and we can invest in their wellness,
as
you were saying before. And I think, you know, coaches are great at giving feedback, like yelling out, snapping out, like, do it this way, do it that way. But until we like actually give a little bit of time and space, and it doesn't even have to be that much. And I tell this to teachers all the time, like, you just got to give a little bit of that time and space to see how, you know, the feedback, the advice, the suggestion can percolate and grow. Like, that's where the magic happens.
Yeah,
that's where
best
we
part.
See like that journey of growth. And I, you know, we're not a podcast that says do these things and you'll feel great. And maybe I should stop saying that, but I'm thinking a little bit about positive youth development and Benson and Scales' work on like developmental nutrients. And I'm going to pull it back and frame it through the work you've done through your dissertation and your countless years as a coach and as a professor and educator and mentor and guide, and think about if you were to pull out a few developmental nutrients, air quotes, that you think coaches should take the time to think about and invest in how it works in their own way of doing things, their own, you know, theory and philosophy of coaching. What would you suggest coaches think about?
Ooh, I got many different thoughts there, but when I would say, probably a couple things I think the first thing that I heard from Carl Adams used to be the wrestling coach at BU, and we used to, after practices, we would end up sitting in the locker room and they would be talking about wrestling guys coming out of practice, and we'd be talking about the football guys. And Carl was a really high level coach. And he said, I want the athlete to go on to the mat and not look back.
Mm.
Meaning, I want them to trust themselves.
Mm.
And that really stuck with me, because a lot of times coaches are just kind of keep trying to fill the kid's head with more and more and more stuff. And I think the second thing I would say comes from a phrase that Tony DiCicco, who was the women's national team coach during, like, when Mia Hamm and all those great national teams.
Soccer.
And I don't know much about soccer, but I know Tony, they came to Tony DiCicco right before this. It was like the World Cup that they won, I think, against China. And a lot of the team leaders came to him and said, are you going to cut us?
Hmm.
And he was like, what? Like, Mia, I'm going to cut Mia Hamm, you know, or like the greatest soccer players in the world. And they said, because you never tell us what we're doing right. And so after that, he actually wrote a book that he called Catch Them Being Good.
Mm.
Wow.
And I've borrowed that. We use it in our program because especially young people, they get corrected a lot.
Yeah.
And especially in school, they're kind of, you know, take your hat off, pull your pants up, do this, do that, do that, don't do that, don't do that. And it's like, I find if we find what the kid is doing right, and that's the foundational thing for them to build off of, then they can feel, oh yeah, I'm doing that right. Yeah. And then later, they know sometimes when they're not doing something right. You know, I would say, like, when a in football, like, guy drops the ball and the coach goes over to him, you can't drop that.
It's like, no kidding.
Like, the kid's like, are you, no kidding, dude. Like, of course I can't drop that. You think I wanted to drop? You know, it's like all that's in their head. And,
yeah.
But then they just have to tolerate it,
yeah,
and say, yes, coach. And so I think that Catch Them Being Good has a really broad possibility for application, because then you have to do a lot of noticing of what, even the kids that are the most difficult, we have to now find what they're doing right, and then they can really have some success and build off of that. And then there's the trust, wait, this person sees me in a different way.
Well, Coach Mac, real quick, that is so sports psychology, because it focuses the kid on what to do versus trying to not do what they shouldn't do. And the more you focus on what you should be doing, or want to be doing rather, and the less fear you have about messing up, the better you're going to play, because you're more focused on visualizing what you want to do and all that.
Yeah. And I just think we, back to the, like, how do we help young people or in any setting?
Mm.
Like, all this stuff is like you mentioned, this is parenting, it's leading a business, it's coaching, there's really no place that you couldn't use that same approach. And then the last thing I would say about it is just like learning to ask more questions, because I think coaches are, they're charged with being the expert.
Yeah.
And it's the expert model. So then they think they have to be the expert in everything, about I know you and I know what you can do. And I know, it's like, no, they don't. They don't know. They get things so wrong sometimes. And I think the longer I coach or even teach or even be a parent is like, what do you think? You know, or what's the matter? Or what's bothering you? Or what's in the way? Or what's just asking questions, because we find out so much more
yes
from the athlete And then we can adjust. Oh, if you need that, and I got you there. You know, I can help you do this.
Yes.
If that's what you're worried about, that's easy. But it's like, if you don't know, you're really, you know, flying without any instruments. You know, it's like the questions are still hard for me sometimes to make myself do it. But when I do it, my favorite one that I'll leave you with is like, I learned to say, would you like some coaching?
Mm-hmm. Me too. Asking, I love that too.
Asking permission.
Yeah.
And if the kid says no, then you say, okay.
Yeah.
I'm backing off for a while.
It's great.
Because now you're giving them the choice. That's very counseling psychology, right?
It's 100%.
Like, so it's like,
I have so much exposure to just asking questions. The more you do it, the more you get used to it.
Yeah. But have you ever had a coach that asked you that?
Right, no.
And it's like, I played football, basketball. I played a lot of baseball. I played all those sports. And no one said, hey, would you like some coaching now? And I'm sure I would have said yes, but it just feels so different.
Yeah, 100%.
And it goes back to how we started, right? Are we encouraging compliance or are we encouraging this like engaged investigation of how do we make tweaks, advancements, or maybe just stay where we are to be able to contribute and find some joy in sports and athletics?
I would definitely say most of the approaches in coaching are aimed at compliance. Mm. And I think an alternative model would be more about their learning and investment and engagement, which that's your expertise. But it's also very counseling psychology in terms of like, I don't know the answer, right? Mm-hmm, totally. Jerry, you're great at that. It's like, let's slow this down a second. Like, let's figure out, tell me what's up, you know? And that, if we could infuse that counseling, that's why I was so excited about, you know, counseling psychology really fits with positive development and it fits with coaching.
Yeah.
And it's really, how do we bring that counseling, the best parts of counseling psychology into coaching, to me seems like a worthwhile endeavor.
Ready? Here's a quick phrase that might help. Be open. Be curious. Be well.
That's all,
there we
Alexis.
Go.
Coach Mac, this has been such a joy. I feel like 5 hours just passed by. Hey, we could keep going. I have so much energy to keep talking with you.
Yeah.
You're just such a special guy, and you're so important in the program, and the students love you and adore you and just benefit so much from you. And we appreciate you so much. We hope that this interview really shines a light on you and all that you contribute just in so many ways. And we appreciate you on many levels. So thank you for joining us, and we will see you soon for sure.
Thank you so much for this, you know, fun opportunity.
Yeah, stay tuned. This is just a preview of what's to come.
Oh, watch out.
Thanks for tuning in to the Read Connected podcast. Please remember that this is a podcast intended to educate and share ideas, but it is not a substitute for professional care that may be beneficial to you at different points of your life. If you are in need of support, please contact your primary care physician, local hospital, educational institution, or support staff at your place of employment to seek out referrals for what may be most helpful for you. Ideas shared here have been shaped by many years of training, incredible mentors, research, theory, evidence-based practices, and our work with individuals over the years, but it's not intended to represent opinions of those we work with or who we are affiliated with. The Reconnected podcast is hosted by siblings Alexis Reed and Dr. Gerald Reed. Original music is written and recorded by Gerald Reed. Editing and recording was done by Cybersound Studios. If you want to follow along on this journey with us, the Reconnected podcast will be releasing new episodes every 2 weeks each season. So please subscribe for updates and notifications. Feel free to also follow us on Instagram at Read Connected Podcast. That's Read Connect Ed Podcast, and Twitter at Read Connect Ed. We are grateful for you joining us and look forward to future episodes. In the meanwhile, be curious, be open, and be well.